background, and he was a priest, and he truly, as he went along, he started looking at the world more and more from this holy place, and he did rise above his background. He said in one of his plays, "The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. We as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. When machines and computers, profit and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered." He was starting to make these connections, and that's why he was assassinated. And for a lot of people on the right, when they think that Martin Luther King was just a commie, he spoke many times out against the absolute emptiness of communist philosophy, very strongly, very emphatically. And so he was speaking equally against them as he was against the military-industrial complex. And by golly, you know, Eisenhower there, he left office warning America about the military-industrial complex. What happened? Well, that very same military-industrial complex turned around and assassinated the very next president. That's how dangerous it was. And that's what Martin Luther King was speaking against. And that's why he was assassinated. The very same forces that assassinated Kennedy certainly assassinated him. And that's what Bob Just is talking about in this whole article. He's talking about this spirit of totalitarianism, of fascism. There's a real problem with the words here, because we're using words that were used in a certain sense back in the 30s, and they have a different meaning now. But so he's talking about looking at the issues coming from more of a place of health, of holism, of holiness, if you will. "The hope for America's future lies in love. It may sound corny, but in the end, it's the only way to avoid civil conflict. Permissive weakness will drive these children crazy, but so will judgmental anger." So, and then he talks about Jane Fonda. Her mother committed suicide when she was 12, and of course Henry wasn't exactly the most model father either, and so she had a very emotional, checkered background, and is it any surprise she turned out the way she did? And he talks about other famous liberal Democrats, the parental problems from sexual abuse to alcoholism, Barbara Streisand, Rosie O'Donnell, Bill Clinton. All of these people have had a very checkered background as children. And I see we're running to the end of our program, and I have about 4 more hours of things that could go on here, but I guess we'll just have to wait until next Monday night at 7 o'clock. This is Tom Clooney. It's been good to be with you, and till then.
Good evening, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And we need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us Pastor Robbie Roberson, and we're going to be talking about the Wenatchee sex abuse scandal. Robbie, are you there?
I certainly am, my friend.
All right, fine. Well, for our listeners who do not know about the Wenatchee sex abuse ring, which, of course, you were the ringleader of this, why don't you introduce yourself and tell our listeners what this was all about, how you got involved, and, of course, what happened.
Well, for your old listeners out there, long-time listeners, it's probably going to be old hat, but I know that all the time you're picking up new listeners, and we praise the Lord for that. And just kind of a condensed version, back in 1994, many people have heard about the McMartin daycare cases, the Emerald cases, different daycare sex abuse cases that have happened throughout the United States back in the 70s and 80s, and the prosecutions of those. And in 1993, they began investigating, began focusing on sex abuse cases in our greater Wenatchee community. I'm the pastor of Pentecostal Church of God Church here in north central Washington. We're about 100 miles due east of Seattle, right over the Cascade Mountain Range, and kind of an isolated place in the middle of no man's land, basically. I pastor a church here. Our products, we are mainly an agricultural apple producing. We are the apple capital of the world, is what Wenatchee is known for. And we're divided, Wenatchee and East Wenatchee is divided by the Great Columbia River. And in that division is Chelan County on the Wenatchee side and Douglas County on the East Wenatchee side of the river. And so that kind of sets it up. But in 1994, we had a police officer, Detective Robert Perez, who all of a sudden began to investigate sex abuse cases. And he literally, his first arrest was January the 3rd of 1994, when he was given the position as crimes against citizens' role within the Wenatchee Police Department. And he began arresting people. And by the time September rolled around, it all of a sudden had gone from isolated individual sex abuse cases into a huge sex ring. And in September the 26th of 1994, he actually arrested the mother and father of some of the children who were in my church. And at that point, I began to really do some digging, even more than I had previously. We've had a couple other kids who were placed in my church by the Department of Social and Health Services the year previous because their parents had been involved in this. I worked closely with the state services, DSHS, because of my food bank operation and so on and so forth here, where we fed about 9,000 people a month. So I had a good relationship. Some kids that were involved in my church, I began to talk to them. I realized that something was not right. And then in September the 26th of 1994, Harold and Idella Everett were arrested for abusing their own children, and I knew this didn't happen. I began to gather more information, more evidence, went public with it. In March of 1995, and at a public meeting on March the 23rd of 1999, I produced all that, the documentation, therapist reports, and so on and so forth, showing that what the police department and prosecutors and the local newspaper had been saying and radio stations was totally inconsistent with the reports from the counselors and from the children themselves. And I went public with that. It went on CBS News, promoted by Mr. Tom Grant, a reporter out of Spokane, Washington. It hit the national news, very critical of what was going on here. At that point, I had massed together enough evidence to show that that this whole thing was hokey, that there was no evidence of any sex ring in our community. That was, like I said, Thursday night, March 23rd, and on Tuesday morning, March the 28th, they came in with a force of Washington State Patrol people, the local law enforcement agencies, crime lab teams, and they arrested both my wife and I. They took me into custody here at my church, and then they went up to the college and arrested my wife while she was taking a homeschooling certification course, put us in jail on $1 million bail, and we remained there for 4.5 months until our bail was finally reduced. And we were, at that point, we were accused of molesting not only dozens of children in our church, but even our own little, at that time, four-year-old daughter, Rebecca. And ultimately, we went through the proceedings, and we were found not guilty. We were acquitted on December the 11th of 1995, got our daughter back finally because of numerous phone calls and pressure from different talk show hosts and important people around the United States. And 2 days later, we got our daughter back on December the 13th. And since then, I've been a very vocal advocate in support of the 26 people who were incarcerated and who were put in prison. And 2 years ago, finally, in December, I was able, through the assistance of the Innocence Project Northwest, we were able to get every single person, literally, out of prison. We had their cases either reversed or totally dismissed, but on appeals in the appellate courts, they got everybody, they freed everybody. And so, thank the Lord, to this day, the terrible injustice, at least somewhat has been righted, but we continue, you know, here it is 8 years later that I've been involved, and I'm still fighting this battle against the system, Dr. Stan.
Well, of course, I think the significant thing about this is that the courts, the newspapers, the police, they all conspired against, yes, even the churches refused to take a stand on this and refused to acknowledge, even after Pastor Robeson was acquitted and exonerated, refused to condemn the corrupt police and the corrupt courts and the corrupt prison system. Now, it doesn't mean they were all corrupt. It simply means the predominantly they were corrupt. When they put Pastor Roby into the prison, they specifically did everything they could to be sure that he would be beaten and mistreated. And they even tell some of the one of the prisoners that he would be rewarded if he killed you?
Oh yes, not just one. It was numerous ones, and actually they were came in as witnesses for us. They were my enemies in there. One of them I actually led to Christ while I was in there, and he was the one who'd split my head open, and while he beat it into a steel staircase, and our case, our federal case against Chelan County Regional Jail, stands in the books today as a case law where failure to protect, numerous other things, failure to provide adequate medical support, so on and so forth. All of these things, we won all of that, and of course, even though we won, you had a federal magistrate who took a very huge, close to $1 million. I think it was around $700,000. I don't remember exactly, but a huge award, a jury award, and he reduced it down to $1 and vacated the original jury award. So, but we still won on principle, and yet even today, you know what this has done to us. Not only our reputations, but the church that we had. It's just a tiny church now. We continue to share Christ. We try and do what we can to lead people to the Lord and you know, just what churches do. But yet the impact that we had on the community back in 1995 prior to our arrest and the impact now is just like night and day. And yet I have to believe that not only these 26 that we were able to get freed from prison, but the many throughout the United States, and literally I can say throughout the world, who we've consulted with since 1995, the Lord has opened up a new area, has given us, I won't say a new ministry, but he has given us insight and an education into the legal system where a lot of people, in ourselves included, we just did not believe that such an unjust system. You know, once in a while that people can make mistakes, but what we found out in Wenatchee, and then ultimately have found out throughout the United States, just like Waco and Ruby Ridge and so many others, people believe that these are isolated cases where you have prosecutors and law enforcement agencies who just literally went on wrong information or whatever. But what the people need to realize is that this information was created by they themselves. It wasn't something that they went off on and made a mistake at, they're the ones who, in fact, created the case and then went about to prove the case, and literally a frame-up. And many cases around the United States, I can tell you today, Dr. Stan, they are frame-ups. There's a lot of innocent people in prison, and especially when it comes to sex abuse cases, where DNA is now proving. And many people believe it's up over 70% of those who are in prison today across the United States for sex-related offenses are there improperly, that these people did not do what they're doing. And where there's been DNA evidence, it definitely has supported that position.
Well, there have really been well over 100 people who are on death row ready to be executed, who, of course, been released. And the story is a recurrent one. Well, the police withheld evidence that would have exonerated. They would have a confession from somebody else, and they would never, of course, submit that confession. Or they would cover up evidence, exculpatory evidence, that would have exonerated the person. Now, that is illegal. But, of course, when the prosecutor does it, he is never held responsible. I mean, how many prosecutors do you know have been sent to prison for intentionally sending an innocent person to jail when they knew they were innocent? In fact, this very famous case recently has come out, and the FBI back in Boston sent a man that they knew was innocent to jail for 30 years to cover up for a murderer that they were using to inform on the mob. And this is not an uncommon story. And if you have never read the book Deadly Alliance, let me recommend it very much so, because it goes into the case. A man went to prison for 30 years and the FBI knew about it. And that's J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. And they're the people who are supposed to be protecting us and investigating what happened on September 11th. And no, the thing is, organization is corrupt. Now, there are a lot of good FBI agents. I'm not saying they're not, but they're not at the very, very top of the ladder. And if you are an honest, hardworking, dedicated, patriotic FBI agent, you're never going to get up to the upper echelon
of
the organization.
Well, it's kind of like, you're right, Dr. Stan, and it's like I shared with the congregation, it's impossible to be a Christian hooker, at least a Christian hooker for very long, if you're truly a Christian. And what I'm finding out today within in law enforcement and the law and justice system, that that you will not remain a Christian and remain in that position for very long, because one of two things will happen. Either you will change your convictions to become like them, or you'll leave, because they will not allow you to continue to be a part of them. And, you know, during the literally just dozens and dozens of depositions that we've taken over the years of both law enforcement people, prosecutorial people, we've actually deposed prosecutors that were involved in this, Department of Social and Health Service, state workers, and we have yet to find an honest person who literally was willing to come forth with the truth. Any truth that came out of them, it was pried out of them, it was forced out of them, one way or another. If it came out, it came out not because they were willing. It came out because they were caught between a rock and a hard spot and had to divulge the truth.
Now, of course, there were people working. There was one man who worked for the Department of Social Services who actually fled in fear for his, they were going to take away his children if he came out in support of you. What was that story about?
Paul Glasson, and definitely Paul Glasson, when they came after my wife and I and they took our little girl, Paul Glasson said immediately he knew, because he had been criticizing Detective Bob Perez and the prosecutions, what was going on in these cases, and he finally spoke up. And I've got to tell you, Paul wasn't always a friend. In fact, the early cases that actually, you might say, were the root of the sex ring cases were actually Paul Glasson's. They were his caseload. They were kids on his, that he was handling. And many of the things that Paul knew, he basically kind of turned a blind eye at that point to it too. But until he began to realize that they were coming after him for becoming vocal finally, in fact, what happened, it got too entrenched. If he had spoken up immediately early on, none of this would have happened. But what happened, he kept silent for too long. And then when he finally spoke up, the strength of the law enforcement people had become such that Paul's words, they carried very little strength. But thank God he was not prosecuted, even though they tried to. They tried to get him for tampering, witness tampering. They actually took it to trial. He was found innocent. The rest of the case was dismissed against him, and ultimately he was dismissed as a caseworker from the Department of Social and Health Services. But while he was on home leave, when they came after my daughter, and myself and my wife and came after us. Paul knew at that point that it wouldn't be too long before they came after him. And he literally, in the middle of the night, without packing up their household, their home, they literally, he put his wife and his little boy, he's Jewish too, by the way, wonderful man. I just really love Paul and his son and his wife. And they, in the middle of the night, packed up without saying anything to anybody and headed across the border. His wife, Suzanne, was a Canadian citizen and had dual citizenship. And he literally, in the dark of the night, went across the border, which was only about 100 miles away from us here, and immediately got out of the state of Washington and went into Canada. And ultimately, what they did when he was looking for work up there during the course of all of these sex ring cases, they actually sent a memo to the red-coated, what do you call it, Canadian Mounties, and said that Paul Glasson had been involved in a huge sex ring involving over 50 children and hundreds of adults, and that they literally had sent that memo. And, of course, it came back to bite him ultimately because Paul himself filed a lawsuit against the city and against the state, and he did that from up across the Canadian border. But to this day, he has chosen to live up there and be a Canadian citizen because he is fearful of coming back to the state of Washington and to the system that the United States of America has.
Well, unfortunately, not every area is quite as bad as yours is, but
I don't agree with you, Pastor Stan. That's something that you know, 5 years ago, maybe 6-7 years ago, I would have said. But what I have known since then is that, you know, I've gone and consulted with cases. I mean, literally, have driven to try and help families over in Idaho, down in California, numerous people, you know, back in Washington D.C. and Boston. In fact, there's some places actually worse. I mean, Massachusetts is terrible when it comes to prosecuting these cases, such as Gerald Amerold. And, you know, and they had an opportunity to pardon him finally, and they blatantly left him off the pardons list last week. It was just really sad. You know, you mentioned a little bit ago about the death penalty of those on death row. A week ago, a federal judge actually passed down a ruling, and it stated that the death penalty was unconstitutional. Because he, at this point in reviewing it, he realized that the prosecution of innocent people was happening, and the federal court out of Montpelier, Vermont, I believe it was, is one of the federal jurisdictions, and a federal judge actually ruled the death penalty unconstitutional because of the obvious problems that they're having in providing not only proper defense, but the prosecutorial, the malicious, just bitter, vindictive, hateful people who don't really care even about exculpatory evidence like what you were talking about earlier, evidence that would free a person. You know, a prosecutor, his role is not just to prosecute a person and to find, you know, and convict them, but also to free an innocent man if, in fact, the evidence supports that. But prosecutors don't do that anymore.
Well, of course, the thing is, this is what happens when a country turns its back on God, and
yeah.
Then you have evil people who are working within the judicial system, supposedly based upon God's law. But now, of course, you know, the more scalps you have on your belt, the more people you can put in prison. We have a district attorney here who prides himself that he gets a 95% conviction rate. Now, you know, I think that shows he's a very skilled attorney. But how many innocent people, you know, are convicted? How many people plead guilty when they're not guilty simply because they threaten to send them to jail for 150 years if they do not acknowledge they were guilty and take a six-month term or a year term in prison? And, of course, what you're doing is giving power to people who do not have a moral foundation. In other words,
correct.
If you don't have God and the Bible as the basis for your right and wrong, then you're going to make up the rules yourself.
Yes.
And when man begins to make up the rules, of course, why we see the end result is what's happening in America today, which is why I believe that God is going to move to judge this nation, and I believe it's going to be very, very soon.
Well, and it's no accident. Everything from 9-1-1 to the Greyhound bus killings, and now look what's been going on the last couple of days with the murders around the Washington, D.C. area with the sniper that's going on. And you know, I mean, the tragedies, the things that are happening here, it's a sign of the times, Dr. Stan.
Well, I think that for some reason, God picked you, and I think he picks people to put them in certain positions at certain times. And although I don't believe totally in predestination, I believe that God rules in the affairs of men and certain people. He has picked, perhaps it appears to be an affliction, but I'm sure what you have done has really been so important, because even though the churches won't speak out, even though the ministers refuse to speak out, there have got to be at least a lot of good people out there who know, but they're not saying anything. They just know that something's seriously wrong, and I think that they're looking and saying, well, why won't my minister speak out? Isn't he answerable to God? And the truth of the matter is we have an awful lot of ministers who have far more fear of government and their social standing than they do of God.
Well, absolutely, and I think a lot of people, unfortunately, even Christians, they really, it's like they leave the responsibility for whatever judgment, whatever chastisement is to come or whatever happens from, you might say, from divine intervention. It's like it's God's job, not our job. And too many people just abdicate that responsibility, and you know, thus you have the Holocaust of Germany and so many other just atrocities throughout history. And it's just terrible, even in our own community, the number of people who you know, have come forward even in the years since the sex ring case and have apologized for remaining silent, but said, you know, we knew that if we were to say anything on our jobs that we would have been fired. We would have been literally at that point taking the unpopular position in the Wenatchee community. And of course, thanks to, you know, the Wall Street Journal and Dr. Paul Craig Roberts of the Washington Times and Trevor Armbrester, when Trevor Armbrester came into Wenatchee and wrote the Reader's Digest story. You know, Trevor Armbrester was devastated because he could not believe that people would tell him about the lack of involvement from the Christian community, and Mr. Armbrester thought that it was just kind of a, you know, an overstatement. And he actually came here to Wenatchee after he had spent numerous weeks and talked to I forget how many hundreds of witnesses, and then wrote the story. But he came after the story came out in July of 1996. And it was the cover story in Reader's Digest and called The Witch Hunt, Wenatchee. And Trevor came and he did a presentation. He flew all the way back here from Washington, D.C., back to Wenatchee, set up a meeting here in the Wenatchee community and did a presentation about his investigation and what he found. And the one thing that devastated him, he says, and I cannot believe, out of all the people I talked to, he said, I never found one single Christian agency, Christian organization in the community who spoke out against this, you know, that would stand up against the injustice in the community. He says, normally, he said, I worked, and he's an elderly journalist, and he worked back in the days of the civil rights issues, and he actually went down south and wrote stories regarding, you know, Martin Luther King and different things, and he said, you know, normally in a community when there's an injustice, he said, the first place you go to, he said, is the church. The church ends up being kind of a focal point, you know, to launch from there to attack whatever, you know, whatever grievance happens to be out there. But he said, in Wenatchee, the church ended up being the last place. He said, they would bar their doors to keep you from.
Well, now, of course, the one good thing was your denomination. What is the Assembly of God actually?
It's Pentecostal Church of God. Almost the same thing as the Assembly. We work very close with them.
But of course, they did stand behind you, didn't they?
Yes, they most certainly did. They actually got a hold of the national office down in Joplin, and they provided mission funds actually to retain the first two attorneys for Connie and I, and that was at the request of a public defender, you know, who contacted my supervisor my superintendent down in Yakima, Washington, and they told Brother Lane, listen, I need to tell you right now, if you don't bring in some attorneys from out of this community to defend, he says, Robbie and Connie, he said, they're going to prison. He said, my firm will not allow me to take and defend them. He said, the worst thing that could happen to this community right now would be to find Robbie and Connie innocent of these charges. And he says, please bring in some other attorneys that will take over this case from me so that they may at least have a chance.
In other words, basically what he was saying was the whole legal system was corrupt, and including the defense attorneys.
Well, absolutely. In fact, I sent you an article today. There was a huge story in the Wenatchee World Sunday regarding Ralph Gosvig, who was another one of the people that we were able to get out of prison, and his case against the county, specifically against the county and the public defender's office. And there's been a number of cases already. The Barker and Howard law firm that has been the that has held the public defender's contract, who defended all these people, he actually made a statement back in 1996 when they were looking for more funds, and he said, without more funds, I can tell you right now, what the attorneys are going to do is basically work to have their clients plead guilty because they don't have adequate funds to defend them. And that's exactly what happened in these cases. They basically would tell their clients, you know, if you don't go ahead and plead guilty to this, then I can tell you right now that they're going to throw the book at you. You're going to prison for life. You can never see the light of day. You need to just plead guilty and throw yourself on the mercy of the court. Well, what happened, what we know now, such as in the Doris Green case, that the prosecutors and the defense attorneys and the judges, all three, literally had talked about these cases or were talking and discussing them as they were unfolding. You know, you and I, we can't go talk to a judge, have an ex parte communication with a judge about our case. You know, it's totally inappropriate. You just can't do it. A judge will not do that. But yet, here you had the prosecutor, the defense attorney, the judge all sitting down to figure out how they can adequately resolve this case, or at least, you know, finish this case off as quick as possible. So they would actually talk to clients, and many of them very handicapped, very low IQ'd, you know, challenged in a lot of areas, but they would talk them into pleading guilty, and they would tell their clients that if you plead guilty to this now and you go ahead and agree to do this, the court will find leniency. Well, the court did anything but find leniency. In fact, prison terms were 46 years, 32 years, 36 years. I mean, it was unbelievable, you know, the sentences that these people were getting. And the prosecutors, or at least the public defenders, they didn't do anything. They never had to defend their clients at all. Basically, they were there to represent them and basically help railroad them into prison. And, of course,
and they were getting paid for it. That's even more inconceivable.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's. I think this year, I think it's around $900,000 is what the local public defense firm is getting to defend the cases for the for the county, for Chelan County, and actually, I believe for Chelan and Douglas County, for both. But it became very obvious that these guys, they believed in the guilt of these people too. And so what you had a public defender who actually was looking to figure out how to represent these people, but at the same time put on such a weak case that the prosecution would have no trouble in enforcing these people to either plead guilty or, you know, be convicted at trial. And there were a couple trials actually over in the Chelan County side where people did. They refused to plead guilty. They went to trial and they were convicted. Ralph Gosvig, Linda Miller, I think there was one or two more, but most of the other 26, all voluntarily, they pled guilty because their public defenders asked them to. And what's interesting is out of the 28 of us who were all finally ultimately charged, I mean, there were 109 people all together identified. There was approximately somewhere in the neighborhood of 42, I think, or 44 arrested for this. Many of the cases, they never even brought charges against them. They went ahead and after investigating, you know, dismissed, you know, went ahead and let them out and just never charged them. But out of the 28 of us that they did charge, it was interesting that every single one who had a private retained attorney, every single case was either dismissed or, like us, we were acquitted. But every single person that had a public defender went to prison.
But of course,
every single person, Dr. Stan.
Right. Well, of course, it just shows the total corruption of the system, and it occurs because the good people do nothing, having forgotten that men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And when the individuals and the church won't stand up, why, of course, society implodes. Well, we're going to take a three-minute break and have a cup of coffee, drink of water. We'll be right back, and we'll welcome your calls at 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will certainly want to join the Radio Liberty family, want to partner with us in our effort to try to bring the American people the information that they're not getting elsewhere, the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And so, of course, you can join the Radio Liberty family if you'd like to by just calling us at 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, some people just subscribe to our newsletter, get our newsletter. If you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, well, I would be glad to send you either the August newsletter, which deals with the true story of what happened with the bombing of the Murrah Building, because, of course, you've never gotten the truth. You do not know. I talked to a gentleman today who investigated this, the relationship between Terry Nichols and the terrorists over in the Philippines. He said that in 1992, why Terry Nichols was over there a meeting with the Islamic terrorists. And, of course, he was there in 1994 and early 1995 when, of course, Project Bajinka was exposed and some of the terrorists were arrested. And, of course, Terry then hurriedly came home. He actually had a round-trip ticket. He forgot about the regular return ticket and bought a separate ticket to get back home here in January of 1995. And then, of course, 3 months later came the attack on the World Trade Center. But, pardon me, the attack on the Murrah Building in Oklahoma City. But you see, you're never going to get that from Barbara Walters or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw, because if we know that the American people, that our government knew about the Islamic connection, why the American people would say, well, why didn't you do something about it in 1995 when you knew about it? Why did you cover it up then, and why are you still covering up the Islamic connection involved with the bombing of the Murrah Building? And the very obvious proof of that is the fact that this very day, in the name of national security, why the FBI, the government, refuses to release the video pictures were taken in front of the Murrah Building on the morning of April 19th, 1995. Why? Because they would show John Doe 2 and perhaps even John Doe 3 and John Doe 4, but certainly at least John Doe 2, and point out that we are letting people responsible for that murder off scot-free, and we're only going after Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, and allowing the Islamic people, part of an Islamic terrorist cell working right there in Oklahoma City, to continue plotting their violence against America. And there are the terror cells all across America are just waiting for the order to be given. Don't think for 1 minute they're not there. Well, that's what Radio Liberty is about. We're going to bring you the information you're not going to get elsewhere. We're heard now on over 50 outlets across America of one sort or another. And with your help, we'll continue expanding. But quite frankly, we do need your help. And if you believe us, if you believe there's a problem, if you believe America is worthwhile fighting for, if you believe that we're involved in a spiritual battle, and behind this, what's going on today, our dark and sinister spiritual forces, truly demonic forces, why, we hope that you'll want to be part of our team. And again, remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We hope that if you're listening to our voice now, that if you're here in the Central Coast of California or really any place in the country, we're going to be putting on a program on the 23rd of November. That's the Saturday before Thanksgiving, an all-day program at the Aptos Seascape golf course. And if you'd like to know more about that, that's an all-day meeting on the 23rd of November, about a month and a half from now. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'd love to see you there, and we'll be back in just a moment with Pastor Robbie. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest is Pastor Robbie Robinson, and we're talking about the Wenatchee sex ring, and of course it was all fraudulent, but of course it came to be something that the courts covered up, the police covered up, the prison system covered up, the newspaper covered up, the media covered up, and of course the churches covered up. And to this day, the churches still refuse to take a stand, even though Pastor Robbie and of course the other people who were charged along with them, they're all out of prison. It was all fraudulent, and yet of course they continue to side with the elite, the people who have the money and power, and they're more interested in maintaining their social position than, of course, doing what is right before God. And when that happens to the churches, all the churches in the community, why, of course, why you can imagine how God looks upon that. The church should be the bulwark of our community, and I think the most tragic part of this incredible story is it is no longer what it was. It's no longer the salt and light of the world. In fact, increasing numbers of people I know now are leaving the organized church and going to home churches, and because it seems that the message and the music of many of our churches has changed, and there's still good people out there like Pastor Robbie, and they're good ministers across America. But so many of them have actually compromised their belief for growth, for prosperity, to be accepted by the world. And God never said we would be accepted by the world. We were just told to be true to Him. Well, our telephone number, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you have a question or comment. And this is really one of the most incredible, incredible stories. And it's an ongoing story. Fortunately, there are good lawyers who have actually been able, willing to take these cases. And actually, of course, you know, whatever happened to that case? Now, you said that the jury came up with a reward of $700,000 or $1 million. The federal judge reduced the award to $1. Is that case going to be appealed to a higher court?
Oh yes, all of that. We've got our cases are on appeal. Even the one last year, we won a jury verdict in that, which found the law enforcement agencies guilty of negligence, police negligence. Which we're the first state in the nation now, out of all 50 states, we're the first one that has a cause of action that holds police accountable for their investigations, and it went before the Washington State Supreme Court in 1998 in the Roberson versus Perez case. We had a favorable ruling on that. We had a civil trial last year. We actually won the trial. My Sunday school teacher and her husband received $3.5 million, and then of course Donna Rodriguez, another one of the ladies in my church, and us, we received nothing. And of course we found out that it was because of a battle that was going on within the jury itself. And anyway, it's a long story, but that's on appeal now. And then just a few weeks ago, we found out that evidence and information that we had requested years ago, it finally turned up in a very unlikely place. And we're finding out now that even police officers who had perjured themselves in the first trial in 1998, and who some of them we didn't use in the trial last year in the retrial, but now we're looking at the possibility of a third trial if, in fact, this appeal goes through, because we're talking about having the court now reverse the jury verdict from last year's trial and to go back for a new trial again, because the obvious, the just blatant lying that went on during the trial last year. So,
well, I think that one of the things we see, we saw this in the New York case, the Lomax case there, where the police officers perjured themselves. They say, well, we're a brotherhood. We have to look out after one another. We have to watch one another in the street. And if one of us gets accused, and one of us commits a crime, everybody else has to stand behind him. And, of course, this is the blue line, which, of course, protects police officers even when they are guilty of horrible, horrible, horrible crimes.
Yes.
And so you really can't really trust any police officer. You can't trust his testimony any longer, because where is his allegiance? Is it to God? I mean, if his allegiance is to God, he's going to tell the truth no matter what happens.
Well,
what happens if his allegiance isn't to God? It's to the brotherhood of police.
It's interesting, Pastor Stan, that you mentioned that, because just here a couple weeks ago, the state of Hawaii literally eliminated, when a police officer takes an oath and says, when you say whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God, the state of Hawaii has now removed that from their oath, believe it or not. And it's just unbelievable. I could not believe it when I saw the sighting and I read the story of that. But many of the law enforcement officers said this is not right, that we should have to say, take an oath when we go to testify, that we should have to say the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God. And so they have removed, the state of Hawaii now officially has removed that, so help you God, from their oath.
But of course then, what is the thing that makes people tell the truth? The fear of perjury? They don't cite police officers ordinarily for perjury. They did this one officer back in New York City that they were intent upon getting, and perhaps he was guilty of perjury. But the thing is that the other police officers covered for him. Now,
yes.
You cannot have a system like that. because now you see that the foundations of liberty, you know, is a judicial system, and people only have to go back and read 1 Samuel chapter 8 to find out what happened to the children of Israel when their court system was corrupt. And ladies and gentlemen, our court system in America is corrupt, going right up to the United States Supreme Court. And that's, of course, why they took God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools, because there is no basis in the Constitution for that. That's why they legalized abortion. There is no right in the Constitution to kill unborn children, or no right for partial birth abortion to kill a partially born child. This is, of course, represents the corruption of the court system. And what do you think God is going to say about that? And what are you going to say about the church that won't speak out against it? That's what frightens me most of all, is to realize that we, I think, very soon are going to see the wrath of God brought on this nation. And I could not say that this nation deserves God's blessing any longer.
Well, you know, one of the sad things too, Stan, Dr. Stan, is that, you know, in our community, you have numerous people, I mean, almost everybody involved in these cases either claim to be Christians or belong to one of the major churches, either the Episcopal or Free Methodist or the Assembly or, anyway, the Nazarene Church, a number of them, the mainstream Methodist churches here in our community. And yet the real battle cry through all of this is that, well, what is this going to do to our taxes? What is this going to do to our taxes? When you've got 50,000 people, you know, on both sides of the river in Chelan and Douglas County approximately, in the outlying areas, looking at their tax rate going up because of multi-million dollar verdicts, these people are very concerned. And so you've got these people in the churches, they're more concerned about their pocketbooks. And literally, I'll just tell you, I call it a Pharisaic spirit. My mother kind of coined that term about this community a number of years ago, even before the sex ring stuff happened. And very Pharisaic spirit. I'd like to be seen as good people. They want people to know themselves as being good people. But the last thing that we'll do will allow even something like this to humble them.
And I think that's really what the problem is. I think you're absolutely right. People do not want to humble themselves before God. They don't want to do what's right. They want to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is the spirit of rebellion, which is so prevalent
witchcraft
in the hearts of men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Bible says this is witchcraft. You know, and that's the sad part about it, and I think it just goes with the time. And so, you know, one of the things, and I don't know if I mentioned this to you the other day, Dr. Stan, but, you know, George Barna, who does statistical reviews of the basically the religious climate of our country each year. He does annual statistics and special ones. And one of the interesting outcomes of the 9/11 terrible terror things that happened a year ago, there was, if you remember, the spike in church attendance throughout the United States for the first few months right after that.
Sure.
Remember that?
Right.
Well, the statistics now, he had a chance to go back a year later, and they came out the following Monday after the 9/11 anniversary. And what they found is that, you know, people were saying, well, look at all the people that are coming to Christ now. And what the Barna report, what the statistics have supported, and statistics can be juggled around, we all know that. But the one thing that they found out that was consistent was that the church spiking was not new converts coming into the body of Christ or people coming to church. What had happened, it had really kind of stirred up the hearts of those who were nominal or infrequent churchgoers. And what it did, it brought the nominal Christian throughout the United States who normally doesn't go, you know, maybe other than a Christmas or an Easter, maybe kids programs or something like that. But all of a sudden, it really stirred the Holy Spirit within them, and it caused them to, in fact, come to attend church services. And what they're finding out, as I went through the statistics, as I told my church a few weeks ago, the thing that really broke my heart is that through this tragedy of thousands of people whose lives were just immediately just snuffed out, that this nation, that you did not see people coming to Christ because of this tragedy. What you saw were nominal or people who were, you know, had been exposed to Christianity coming back to the church, but a year later it was back to the point where it was actually, even with, if not a couple points below the attendance from the year previous. And what that showed me, Dr. Stan, even though I know that the Brooklyn Church in New York, that there's, you know, been an increase in attendance and stuff, but generally speaking, in the United States of America, you could almost say that nobody came to Christ, even after the crisis of 9-1-1. Isn't that tragic?
But the thing is, it wasn't presented in a point that this was God's judgment on America.
Well, exactly.
Jerry Falwell said, and I like Jerry Falwell, but, you know, his remark was, well, this is the fault of the abortionists. This is the fault of the homosexuals. And I shake my finger at you and say, you're responsible for this.
Well, yeah,
and it starts instead of saying, this is a failure of the church. This is a failure of Christians to be the salt and light. God is going to bring his judgment on this nation. And this is simply the first episode. And to return and repent, that would have been the message that should have been put out. And that wasn't the message. We were going to blame the abortionists. Why should we blame the abortionists?
And the homosexuals.
Certainly these people have turned their back on God. What would we expect from abortionists and homosexuals other than evil? What should we expect from the Christians? And
the sad part about that was that, the sad part about that was even after Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell, on Pat Robertson's program, when he said that, immediately after the criticism began to come down, he started backpedaling from that position to explain him. And, I got to tell you, there's not a lot of people out there that I can really take my hat off to anymore in the mainstream. I mean, you and Chuck Missler, there's others that are out there that are saying it like it is, the Southwest Radio Church, Noah Hutchings,
great guy.
But Billy Graham's son, Franklin Graham, took and made the first real, you might say, hit on the Islamic people and what was going on when he said these weren't Methodists, these weren't Catholics, these weren't Protestants flying those airplanes, these were Islam. And of course, President Bush and his cabinet and Republican parties, they came down on him you thought that he was Hitler and they were God because of his criticism of them. And then when the Islamic rabbis and whatever you call them, leadership, demanded of him that he meet with them so that they could explain, so that he could be educated, he said, no, thank you. I don't need to be educated. And then he was further criticized. And, of course, here just a few weeks back, he made another statement about the tragedy in this whole thing is that after a year after this or approaching the anniversary of 9-1-1, still no Islamic leadership in the United States have come out to speak out against it. And he condemned them for it. And yet, because of his condemnation, he himself is condemned. Billy Graham, Billy is a little different. I mean, Dad's a little different than the son, but I really appreciate the tenacity that Franklin Graham had to come out to stand up as for his convictions and refuse to backpedal.
No, I share your applause for him. And the thing that most people don't understand, and this is a little off the subject, but the latest estimates are that about 7 million Muslims in America, but only about 1.6 million of those actually go to the mosque. The rest of them are nominally Muslims, but they're not going to the mosque. Of the mosques, and this is the latest issue of Insight magazine, of the mosques in America, 80% of them are headed by the radical form of Wahhabism. They call them imams, I believe. They're the Islamic clerics there. And, of course, most of them are financed by Saudi Arabia. They're pushing the Saudi Arabian brand of Wahhabism, which is a radical form of Islam. And that is where the danger really lies. And it was this philosophy that was the basis of what happened, on September 11th. And this is what, of course, is not known to the average American. But 80% of our mosques in America are headed by the radical Islamic clerics. So it doesn't mean that every Muslim embraces this, but it does mean that the mosques in America are the centers for this whole revolutionary Islamic movement intent upon the destruction of our country. And I applaud Billy Graham for having the courage to say that. I just wish we had a few more ministers who wouldn't back down as soon as the New York Times and the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal attacks them.
Yes, yes, you're so right, Dr. Stan, you're so right. It's a heartbreak, it really is.
Well, of course, this is not over yet, though, as far as the Wenatchee sex ring is concerned, and I just hope you're going to keep in there until this whole thing has been brought out, and until, of course, the police force is held responsible. And really, I was so disheartened to hear that the good people in your area reelected the corrupt sheriff who went right along with this whole thing.
Yeah.
And his opposition, the man who was running against him because he saw the corruption, would not speak of the corruption because he was threatened that they would withdraw the support from him. And that's what they, how this whole thing works, you know. We're behind you, you know, except we, you can't talk about this or that or the other thing, or of course we'll pull the finances. And of course, people don't understand. You have to do what's right. You don't worry about the finances. The finances will come in from the good people if you're doing what's right. And if you compromise your position, why, of course, you lose the support of the good people and you lose the election down the line. And the good man, and I think is probably well-meaning individual, he lost, what, by 100 and some odd votes?
Yeah, 111 votes, I believe, ultimately. And I really, I'm a firm believer that if he would have just gone on the issue of, I mean, this is the first time we, here you've got the first sheriff in the United States of America that has been found guilty in civil litigation and actually had a jury verdict come back, you know, finding them guilty of negligence. And here you, I mean, a first, and yet here the opposing sheriff is running against him, who happens to be a deputy, by the way, who didn't want to, you know, didn't really want to rock the water that, you know, trouble the water that bad because he was still working there. And, of course, in our community, it's relatively small, so everybody still tries to work as much as possible with everybody, you know, they don't want to just plain go for the throat, so to speak. But I believe that if Joe Hinkle, Deputy Hinkle, had said, look, we've got a negligent sheriff. This is what they've done. This is what he's done over the last 8 years of his administration. We need a change here. It has brought embarrassment and shame to our community what this man has done. But he did. In fact, he refused to even take opportunities. He wouldn't even comment on it because his supporters and the ones who were, out there trying to promote him said, no, we don't want this even brought up. We don't want this made an issue. We don't want our community to be made a laughingstock anymore.
Yeah, but you're already a laughingstock, and it's only going to get worse.
Well, and I believe that. And I, you know, with this case, with Ralph Gosvick's case coming up next month in November, in federal court, and Doris Green's and a number of the other ones, there's, I think, close to 25 cases out there now that are lawsuits that have been filed or are being filed altogether, you know, against the city of Wenatchee and the state of Washington and the prosecutors. And, of course, the latest one now, in a lot of the information they've got out, they're actually able to go after the public defenders and the attorneys that represented them and the prosecutors for malicious prosecution, which has been, they have been almost totally immune from any kind of prosecutorial wrongdoing.
But now they can actually be charged. And,
that's right.
Correct. Now, the thing is that there is information on Detective Perez, who really instigated this whole thing. And they have been concealing the information. I know you can't tell us what the information is, but they had the records on him. There were certain questions about his past or activities.
Yes.
And they intentionally lied and said the information wasn't there. Well, they had it all the time.
Yes.
Well, isn't that perjury?
Well, not only is it, I don't think of perjury because really that had not been brought up, you know, under oath. It is perjury regarding depositions. So, yes, it is. When you do a deposition, you sign it and said that if you've lied in this deposition, that you are, you know, can be charged with perjury and so on and so forth. Since I've talked to you last, another interesting thing, we actually had one of the Wenatchee police officers, Mike McNaughty, who testified in the 1998 trial. He had written a memo to the Wenatchee Police Department, to his chief and to the department, Rick Murray, the captain, and stated that, you know, I'm aware of the grandfather of all sex abuse cases, which was the McMartins, but Wenatchee by far is the granddaddy of all sex abuse cases. And he said, we need some help. And he said, I'm having some problems with this. Well, in the course of and I'm trying to find the video right now, or the transcript of his testimony, but Mike McNaughty back then stated that that was the only communication, that was the only time that he had criticized the investigation or had made the department aware of the fact that he was concerned about what was going on. Well, here a couple days ago, two or three days ago, I found out that it's not at all, that he had written other communications and that those communications had also been destroyed. And they've surfaced. I don't know how the attorneys got him or who gave them to him or just what, but now it's going to come back to bite him. And so here you had another Wenatchee police officer, and of course this man is the Christian of the whole bunch, and he is the, you know, he is supposed to be the one carrying the cause of Jesus Christ, and of course, he's the one who basically, and I have to say, is the one who put the frame up against the church here for me when they began questioning Detective Perez and what he was doing. Mike McNaughty, who stepped into the case to assist Perez, was the one who at that point began to create the case against my church and against myself.
Well, now, of course, the thing is that as this whole story comes on down and we find more and more evidence of perjury and withholding information, I know that they had to bring in judges from outside to so you could get a fair trial, because all of the judges in your area were corrupted and you know, were involved. And did they recluse themselves, or they just go right ahead and hear the case even though they had no business doing it?
No, they refused to recuse themselves, and that's why it finally took the intervention of the both the State Court of Appeals and ultimately the State Supreme Court to appoint Judge Donahue, for instance, to hear these cases, and also Judge Wallace Friel out of, I believe, Clark County, and anyway, one of the other counties, Lincoln or something, to come in to review these. And, of course, when they brought outside judges in to really examine the evidence and the facts, they were just blown away. They were just shocked.
Well, now, what about the thought of getting the state attorney general to bring charges of perjury against some of the people when you can prove that they've sworn falsely? Will the state attorney general touch that?
Well, I was really hoping that Ashcroft, with the things that have happened, that Ashcroft, you know, coming in, being from an Assembly of God background, and his father being superintendent and so on and so forth, and knowing the kind of structure of that maybe we might have a chance of readdressing some of these issues. But in 1995, actually the governor, at that time Governor Lowry of our state, I had met with Governor Lowry after our acquittal, and I appreciate him. I like the man. He was a Democrat. He's kind of off the wall in some things, but he actually requested and sent a letter to Janet Reno requesting that the federal government, that the Attorney General of the United States come in and investigate. And of course, they asked the county prosecutor for two items. If I remember correctly, now we're talking about 1995, 1996, and I believe that they just asked for a list of the defendants and a list of their charges, and basically that was all. And ultimately, they came back and they found emotional abuse, but they couldn't find that the law enforcement or that the prosecutors or the law and justice system had done anything wrong at all. And, of course,
We're going to have to let you go. We're out of time.
Sure.
God bless you. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you later.
Lord bless you, Dr. Stan, and the listeners. Bye-bye.
And, of course, to our listeners in the Great Northwest, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, well, please hold your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY out across America or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Let me give those numbers again because we'll probably take calls at the half hour. That's 464-8295. Or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 888-245-4237. 245-4237. Because right now we have on the line with us Chris Milligan, and I've talked to Chris just one time before. He publishes books up in Oregon, and he put out a book called Barry and the Boys, and we really should get the author on again, or maybe even get Chris to talk about that. This is the story of one of the most important drug smugglers in America. His name was Barry Seal. And he had strong ties to, of course, George Herbert Walker Bush. He had strong ties to the CIA. He was a CIA operative and the largest drug smuggler in the United States. And this is all beautifully bought out in the book, Barry and the Boys. And, of course, the boys were people tied into the CIA. The largest drug smuggler in the United States is the Central Intelligence Agency. We would not have so many people in prison or so many people addicted to drugs if it were not for our that's our tax dollars at work, the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, this is not the whole CIA, but it is a certain component of the CIA. They're involved in criminal activity. And, of course, everybody in the world knows that except the American people. And that is simply a reflection of the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think. But this evening, we're not going to be talking about Barry and the Boys or the CIA, other than to point out that many members of the Skull and Bone Society go into the CIA, and there is a Skull and Bone Society clique within the American Central Intelligence Agency. But Chris has republished Anthony Sutton's book, The Establishment, with a hardback and with a new preface and with a list of the members of the Skull and Bone Society in the back of the book, which means that it'll be much more comprehensive than the softbound cover, which we've traditionally carried here at Radio Liberty, and we'll mention later on that we will be carrying Chris's copy as well, because we think it's important to have a hardbound copy and to have this additional information. But Chris, you've actually had an opportunity then to meet Anthony Sutton, the author, didn't you?
Yes, I did, sir.
And, of course, Anthony Sutton used to live right here in Santa Cruz, and that's where I got to know him. And he, of course, had been researching the various conspiratorial movements in America. He had written extensively when he was at the Hoover Institute about how the United States had financed the Bolsheviks and continued to finance the Bolsheviks right up to and through the Vietnam War. And, of course, the Vietnam War would have been lost by the North Vietnamese had not we continued financing the Soviets, who are financing the North Vietnamese. In essence, we created the best enemy money can buy. And in fact, I even have a video, an interview I did with Professor Sutton back in 1980 by that title, and we have a book by that same title that he wrote, The Best Enemies Money Can Buy. We financed the Nazis, we financed the Soviets, we financed the North Vietnamese, and of course, I hate to say it, but today we're financing this whole world terrorist movement, giving us the best enemy money can buy. And if you doubt that, you need to get my latest newsletter. That's the September newsletter. We go into the background and give you the sources of documentation for that. And if you read that newsletter and you have any question at all about who created this world Islamic movement, well, I'll be very, very surprised. But tonight we're going to be talking about the Skull and Bone Society. And this, of course, is such an important organization because not only is the president, the current president, a member of this, his father, George Herbert Walker Bush was a member. The grandfather, Prescott Bush, was a member. There have been either, I guess, about eight going on, nine members of the Bush family who belong to this secret society. What can you tell us about this secret society? Should we be worried about it, Chris? Is this simply another example of a college fraternity? Or are there some rather sinister implications in this organization that dates back to 1832 when it was first formed there on the campus at Yale University?
Well, I personally think that we should be concerned about it, the level of secrecy and the ties to the things such as drug running and other aspects of the society. I really think that we should take up and notice. How I became involved in it initially before Mr. Sutton was from my father, who was in the CIA, and matter of fact was branch chief, head of all of East Asia for research and analysis. And he took me aside one time and told me, he says, the Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it. And then he said communism was a sham. These same secret societies were behind it. And he had started his intelligence work working at the Library of Congress, in the basement of the Library of Congress, under Archibald MacLeish, who was OSS and who was Skull and Bones. And he had traveled to Vietnam in 56 and met with Colonel Lansdale and was asked to be involved with the drug running, and would have nothing of it. And within 2 years, he had taken the family, moved from the Washington, D.C. area out to the West Coast and started a teaching school.
Your father?
Yes.
All right, so he didn't want any part of this then?
No, he didn't. So I looked into it for many years and was trying to, you know, and then heard rumors about Skull and Bones and tried to find some information, and it was just wasn't available. And then I heard somebody on the radio, and they mentioned Skull and Bones, and I called up and got a phone number for this person and talked to them, and they told me about Mr. Sutton's book. And it's about 88, about 2 years after his pamphlets had been put together in one book and been all put together. And I read his book, and I said, gee, this ties a lot of things together. And so getting back to your question, should we be worried? As citizens of a republic, yes, we should be, because the secrecy that these people, that the secret society ascribes to, has no place in our republic. We need to know what is going on. And another interesting point about George H.W. Bush is that when he was vice president, he was head of two working groups, his highest jobs, and they were head of the War on Drugs and the War on Terrorism. And that gentleman that you mentioned before, Barry Seal, when he was murdered in 86, he had in his pocket, in his wallet, the George Bush's private phone number, and he was one time sitting in a office with his lawyer, and his lawyer says, Barry, what's going on? Because Barry, you know, he'd get in trouble for in trouble for explosives or narcotics, but he would never go to jail. And so he's talking with his lawyer, and the lawyer says, Barry, what's going on? And Barry says, you want to know what's going on? Just call this number and tell him you're me. And so the lawyer called the number, and the lady at the end of the phone answered Office of the Vice President and got handed off to a general. And you have the situation where what Mr. Sutton talks about, and one of the things that he brought up in his preface was that he had really hoped when he had first released some of this information about Skull and Bones, and he is release some of the most detailed information about it, that there would be some sort of debate or some sort of questioning in the population about the Hegelian dialectic, which he brought up. Because by using the terrorism and the drugs, they use the old Hegelian dialectic where they create the problem and the solution to the problem to get to the new place where they want to go. And so by having, you know, these terrorists and the drug war, they're able to circumvent our republic and scare people into thinking, you must give up your rights because, we need to make the world safer for you.
Yeah, and of course, the drug war on drugs, we're fighting the war on drugs the way we fought the war in Vietnam. We're not trying to win, but out of the war on drugs comes a forfeiture where they can come in and seize your property simply because, well, there's a... Maybe they find some drugs there. Maybe somebody's renting one of your offices, and they find some drugs in that office, so they seize your property. Now, you can fight them, and maybe you can win, but it'll cost you more than the property is actually worth. But, of course, the government gets to keep that and divide the money up with the local law enforcement, and everybody benefits. They get new motorcycles and new tanks and new flak jackets and all of these things purchased with the price of your office that you had nothing to do with drugs. But of course, this is how the system works, and so many Americans feel, well, gee, we got to fight this war on drugs, and so let's give up our freedom, let's give up the right guaranteed to us in the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, because how else are we going to defeat those wicked drug smugglers?
Right.
And yet, of course, what people don't understand, those wicked drug smugglers have always worked with the Central Intelligence Agency and the CIA agents who tried to come forward and tell the truth about what really happened and their involvement, where many times they were forced or fooled or coerced into being involved in drugs. And the CIA agents who tried to come forward and tell the story, many of them have been sent to prison on trumped-up charges, and that's covered in certainly the book Drugging America by Rodney Stitch or Defrauding America. And we have so many books and so many people we've interviewed. We have even a four-tape set. It's actually six interviews. Is there really a war on drugs? No, there's not a war on drugs.
No.
It's a war on the American people.
Yes, and it goes back even farther. I mean, one thing that I really enjoy history. Enjoyed history as a child, and have always read a lot. And one thing that my research has found out is that the drug smuggling didn't start now. This drug smuggling started in the 1800s, and actually you had a series of drug trades that helped build up and capitalize the West. And actually, the first drug trade was the sugar industry. And you had a lot of these people and their forebears involved with this, and you had the rum and the slave trade, and it was like a three-pronged trade between England and Africa and the West Indies with the rum and the slaves and the sugar. And then in 1830s, opium became the largest commodity on the planet. And you have a situation where the Russell Company, which was the largest American concerned in the smuggling business, was formed in the 1820s, and this was started by Samuel Russell, who was, in some books it says a cousin, other ones it says half-brother of William Huntington Russell, who was the founder of Skull and Bones. And you have a lot of the families that are involved with Skull and Bones were involved with this activity in the 1830s up until 1860s after when we had the Second Opium War. And
now remember, for our listeners out, the opium wars were not fought to stop the trade in opium. They were fought to open up the trade in opium so the British could bring the opium into China and corrupt the people there. And the Chinese emperor didn't want that, but he was defeated. And
right.
Of course, so that they could bring the opium in, and it was the British who were doing that. But you see, we're not supposed to know that part of history. We're supposed to think that the opium wars were fought to stop the opium trade. No, not at all. But
no.
To open up and legitimize this terrible, terrible trade in human suffering.
Right, and the Americans' involvement is largely overlooked. In a lot of books, it'll say that it was just the British mercantile houses, but in the early 1800s, the British East India Company didn't allow their ships to to carry the opium anymore. They sold it in India, and they cultivated in India, but they weren't allowed to carry it anymore. And the Americans had developed the clipper ship, largely because we were smuggling a lot of tea into the United States, because when America was a colony, we weren't allowed as a people to carry on trade. We had to deal with British East India Company. They had a monopoly on tea. In other words, if we wanted to buy tea, we were supposed to buy it from the British East India Company. But they developed the clipper ship and were able to actually go out and meet other ships, Dutch ships and whatnot, and bring the tea back. And a lot of years, the amount of tea drank versus the official numbers of tea drank was there was a lot more. And so when the clipper ship got involved in the China trade, the Americans took over a big bulk of the China trade, and then were also the main procurers of opium in Turkey. And I mean, there was Roosevelts were involved with this, and the Lovett family, the Bush family. There was the first consul in Hong Kong was an F.T. Bush. You had Bush and Wild Company and Bush and Comstock Company that would own some of the clipper ships. Then after it became legal, opium became legal after the Second Opium War, the Chinese that these smugglers were selling it to says, wait a minute, we don't need you smugglers anymore. I can just call up India and have a boatload sent to me, and I'll pay the duties and everything. So all of a sudden, they stopped making, and these smugglers weren't just making a little money. They were making huge amounts of money. And a lot of the big fortunes on the Eastern Seaboard were at that time were made out from opium. And they took this money and then reinvested it and built the railroads and grabbed a bunch of the land. I mean, you have Mr. Weyerhaeuser was also a member of Skull and Bones. And the interesting point is that the Spanish-American War came about. The Maine blew up in the harbor, and they got jingoistic and flapdoodling here and got the country all up in an uproar and said we had to go save the Cuban people because the Spanish were treating them so mean. And we had to go save the Cuban people and avenge the Maine.
The Maine was the slogan. It's sort of like
right.
Remember the World Trade Center.
Right, but what happened first was we took the Philippines. You know, right after war was declared, we didn't go into Spain. I mean, we didn't go into Cuba, but Dewey took the Philippines. And it was very interesting how that happened. Teddy Roosevelt, who was the Undersecretary of Navy, had worked out a thing with Dewey a little bit beforehand, and then one day the Secretary of Navy happened to go home early. He had a bout of the gout and went home early, and Teddy sat up to the desk and sent off a whole bunch of orders and had Dewey go over and take Manila.
That was Admiral Dewey. Oh, Dewey was the morning upon that month in May, and Dewey was the admiral down in Manila Bay, and Dewey were the regent's eyes and six of oro blue, but do we feel discouraged? I do not think we do. That I learned that in college. That was the slogan that they used during the Spanish-American War.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Dewey sunk the Spanish fleet, and then now, of course, it wasn't long after that, Teddy Roosevelt led the charge up at San Juan Hill, went down in history, and prepared to become the President of the United States.
Right, they took the Philippines, and actually the Philippines had been fighting the Spaniards at that time, and they were really kicking the Spaniards behind, and we kind of met them at the beach, and they says, boy, didn't we really kick those Spaniards? And Dewey says, well, that's kind, little brown brother, but we need to take care of you. So we all of a sudden became an empire and took over the Philippines, and then the first military governor there was Arthur MacArthur, and the first civilian, and we fought a 2 to 3 year war there that was more vicious than Vietnam. We went in and killed complete villages and did a horrendous war. And the first civilian governor was William Howard Taft.
He was a Skull and Bones, too.
He was Skull and Bones and the founder of the son of founder Alonzo Taft. And
now, I thought that William Howard Taft, of course, had been the president, what was that, about 19...
he took on after Teddy Roosevelt.
Right.
And so he went there about 1900.
Okay, fine. So Spanish American War was 1898. So
right. And he was the civil governor. And while he was there, if you read about William Howard Taft, he was a jurist, and the thing that he really wanted to be was he wanted to be on the Supreme Court. I mean, it was, you know, he carried it on his sleeve. It was an open joke to a certain extent. Everybody knew he wanted to be on the Supreme Court. Well, when he was in the Philippines, he got asked twice to be on the Supreme Court, and he turned it down. Finally, Teddy Roosevelt asked him to be Secretary of War, and he said, okay, I'll be Secretary of War. And if you go and look and see, well, what transpired in the Philippines between the time that William Howard Taft got asked to be on the Supreme Court and when he got asked to be Secretary of War? Well, opium became illegal for the first time in modern Asia in the Philippines. And the Philippines also, when they were doing this smuggling in the 1800s, they a lot of times would have two companies with the same name, but one of them would be based in Canton and the other one would be based in the Philippines, so that they could play this semantics game and say, well, you know, in their public pronouncements, they would say, oh, well, no, we don't have nothing to do with opium. We don't smuggle opium and whatnot. But then they had their front companies in the Philippines. So they'd had a relationship with the Philippines for a long time. And then if you look at Taft's career, he started the situation of the Hague Treaty and the Shanghai conferences to make these drugs, certain drugs illegal all over the world. And then these...
And then once they're illegal, then you can begin smuggling, and that's where the real profit is that what
right.
you're suggesting? And so for our listeners, of course, William Howard Taft became president in 1908. He was defeated in 1912 by Woodrow Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, he was appointed not simply Supreme Court Justice, but a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Now, that's pretty good when you have no experience on the Supreme Court and you suddenly become the Chief Justice. But that's how it is when you are a member of Skull and Bones. There have actually been either 8 or 9 Tafts who have been part of Skull and Bones. And this is how you get ahead. Well, let's get back to Skull and Bones, because really this goes from generation to generation. Doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And the theme of them, and it's been going on for a long time. I mean, there were people in Yale that was very upset in the 1870s, and they would write these poems about how it doesn't matter if these guys are bright or they can, you know, they're the best one for the job. If they have the pin on their breast, they get the job.
And of course, George W. Bush was a very, very poor student. He went to Andover and did very poorly. He was in the bottom half of his class, and he never should have been admitted to Yale. But because, of course, his family was Skull and Bones, he was admitted to Yale, and he didn't do very well at Yale either. But of course, he was brought into Skull and Bones because his father and his grandfather and all the other Bushes, there have been, as they say, about 8 Bushes now, Skull and Bones, his uncle, and but this is a family affair. And of course, the thing is, why is Skull and Bones so important? Well, it's not just simply a college fraternity, because there are strong spiritual overtones to what Skull and Bones is all about. And of course, we've had certainly 3 Skull and Bones presidents during this last century, but what happens is that once they get in, they bring in all their Skull and Bones cronies right along with them. But there's a bond that keeps these people. They all help one another. They work with one another. They control banking. They many times control the Council on Foreign Relations. Their people, Ariston was actually the director of the Council on Foreign Relations. They work within the Central Intelligence Agency. They control the media. They simply are one of the dominant forces in America. And yet, of course, nobody is ever allowed to know what this is really all about. And they put out a lot of disinformation. And I'm sure, Chris, as you've studied this, you realize that they are constantly trying to deceive the American people as to what Skull and Bones really is. Do you want to pick up on that thought?
Well, yeah, I mean, the basic story is, they're nothing but a bunch of college boys with some, you know, weird rituals. And, you know, college kids, you know, they're weird anyway. And that's the basic line, but, you know, if you go deep and you just look at the raw power of the organization, they're obviously much more than that. And then also the mystical aspect of the organization and the geomantic qualities of it. There's more than just a fraternity, and they're also allied with a group called a DKE, Delta Kappa Epsilon, which was a junior fraternity started at Yale in the 1800s, and is the only. There was a lot of different junior and sophomore societies. I mean, Skull and Bones is a senior society. You only are a member of it during your senior year, is when you join, and then you're a member for life. And the first time you're a knight, and then you become a patriarch. But a DKE, Delta Kappa Epsilon, went on to become, in their own literature, become an international secret society. And when you add, and both George H.W. and George W. Bush were members of DKE, and matter of fact, presidents of DKE at Yale, which is the Alpha chapter. And then also when you add into that, you have both Roosevelts were member of DKE. Also, you had Rutherford B. Hayes and Gerald Ford, and then also Dan Quayle. I mean, everybody wondered, where's Dan Quayle? Why is this guy going to be vice president under George Bush? And he was also a member of DKE. And
he was not Skull and Bones, though.
No, he was not Skull and Bones, but he was a member of DKE. And the first is Rutherford B. Hayes took over the presidency, very similar situation as George Bush in the 2000 election. Rutherford B. Hayes did not win the popular vote, and they were able to do some collusion in South Carolina, Louisiana, and Florida, and won the Electoral College and made a deal. And at that time, Alfonso Taft was the Attorney General in the Grant administration, and helped make the deal, which put Rutherford B. Hayes into office. And then the thing that also I found that these people are all related. They're, you know, the Bushes are related to the Whitneys and the Phelpses and the Sloanes and the Tafts, and they're all related to the Cabots, is what it seems. And so the thing that really seems to bind them together is blood. And I personally believe that what we're dealing with is a multi-generational cult. And
what was that old saying about the lodges speak only to the Cabots and the Cabots speak only to God, or would have that reverse? Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, of course, and these are, I think that's the important thing. These are intergenerational secret societies. But of course, what is the secret? And we'll get into that when we get back after our break here in just a moment with Chris Milligan. And Chris, of course, has... well, Chris, you can't, of course, talk about anything, but if you'd like to put out the number of your organization, if you have a website, why don't you do that right now?
Probably the best place to go is to TrineDay, TrineDay.com. And there's links there to my research on Skull and Bones. There's some stuff there about Tony's books and other books and videos that we carry.
All right, fine. And, of course, our guest is Chris Milligan, and he is a publisher. And he's written, of course, on Skull and Bones. And he's been fascinated by this information, as you will be, too, as we begin this next half hour exploring what Skull and Bones really is. Is it simply a college fraternity? Well, it is certainly the most secret of all college fraternities, because most people, once they get out of them, of course, they forget about it, or they don't keep in touch with their lodge brothers. But, of course, Skull and Bones, you are sealed to your brothers for the rest of your life. And we've talked to people. Charlotte Isabey is a friend of both of ours. And Charlotte tells how her father and her grandfather us both skull and bones, and were bonded in a very strange manner to all the other men within their class. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we hope that many of you out there will decide right now you're going to join the Radio Liberty family and help us do what we do. And we're really dependent on you, if you believe in what we're doing, to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day with the news, behind the news, the story, behind the story, and all sorts of fascinating guests. And one reason I enjoy doing what I do is because we have a chance, of course, to talk to so many fascinating people and get, of course, their stories down, and, of course, then have the opportunity to bring them to our listeners across America. And we're heard every week on about 50 outlets now. And remember, we just started right here on KFER. What was it, 1994? 1995, and we've gradually increased our base. But first, we can't do this alone. We do it because there are people out there who believe in what we're doing, who care about this country, who care about their children and their grandchildren, and realize, of course, that behind the political and ideological and struggle is a spiritual struggle. And that is the message we keep trying to bring out. And that is, of course, the basic theme of my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and my video and audio tapes. And so much of what we do is that if you're trying to approach this from a political point of view and you want to be a Republican, you want to be a Democrat, of course, you're going to be sadly misled, and you're going to be constantly disappointed because you elect people to do certain things, you think they're going to do it, and they don't do it at all. They continue exactly the way the opposite party was doing when they were in power. Oh, they make a few little changes here, there, and elsewhere. And, of course, on the abortion or homosexual issue, they'll sort of say what you want to hear. That's so they can manipulate the Christians. And most Christians are so incredibly naive that they do not understand that we are up against a supernatural intelligence who knows exactly how to manipulate good people for their own destruction. And so if you continue to listen to our program, and of course we hope you'll tell others about Radio Liberty, we hope you'll tell them about our website at radioliberty.com. We hope you'll go there and pull down our newsletters and pull down our archive programs, and we give you our permission to copy them, to distribute them, to help us get the truth out across America. And of course, we hope that many of you will decide you want to join the Radio Liberty family. Remember our website, www.radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. And so we'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Chris Milligan. And, of course, telephone number, if you'd like to call, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Chris Milligan, we've been talking about Skull and Bones. And of course, this is an amazing organization. And of course, they have initiation ceremonies which are designed to bond people for the rest of their lives. Now, there's a new book that's out called The Secrets of the Tomb that's written by Alexandra Robbins. And I think Alexandra has done a great job. But I do believe that she's been fed information that's not entirely correct. Because, of course, there is enough people who, by one means or another, have been able to get video pictures or other information about what really goes on in these ceremonies. And, of course, supposedly Alexandra was talked to by a number of men who were in Skull and Bones who really just wanted to tell about what it was all about. And I do not believe that anybody who's been through these oaths, at least a very rare person, would dare tell the truth about what the ceremonies involved. I think they would be embarrassed. I think they'd be humiliated. I think they would literally be frightened for their lives, because there is a bond that bonds these people together. And, of course, they would put out false information. In fact, the publication of Alexandra's book, The Secrets of the Tomb, was apparently moved up about a year at publication date to get it out right now, because, of course, many people know that the president was a member of this, although the president, when asked recently about it, his membership in Skull and Bones, said, oh, is that society still around? I didn't even know it still existed, which, of course, was not true at all. When he wrote his autobiography, he said he joined Skull and Bones. It was so secret he couldn't even say anything about it. And yet, of course, he now makes flippant remarks, which is certainly not what you would expect a man who has given his life to our Lord to do. In fact, you would expect him to renounce the pledges and these horrible oaths that he's sworn and the pagan organization which he is a member of. Right now we've got Ed calling from Aptos. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan.
A question or comment?
A comment and a question. Hello?
Go ahead.
My opinion is I didn't care for anything Alexandria had to say. That's just my opinion.
All right.
I had a question for the author. Could he talk about their involvement in the Civil War?
About their involvement in the Civil War?
Yeah, if they started in 1828, I just know like heck that they were involved in the Civil War.
All right, fine. Thank you so much, Ed. The question is, what do you know about the involvement of Skull and Bones in the Civil War?
Well, I'll have to admit I don't know a lot about their involvement in the Civil War. I do know that you had members that were members. There were members on both sides. I do think that they helped do some of the fomentation. There is evidence that they were involved in a lot of the political shenanigans and the intrigue involved up to the Civil War. They were involved in some of the leadership of the secessionist units and the secessionist political, especially in Louisiana and Mississippi and Carolina, is where a lot of some of the members that were from the South that were in Skull and Bones. But you did have, and you still continue today, have a strong presence of members from the South in Skull and Bones.
All right, and I think that during the Civil War they were both in the Confederate and in the Confederacy. So, perhaps somebody can do a lot more study on that. I think Alexandra Robbins, who wrote the book *The Secrets of the Tomb*, did cover that to an extent. And Ed had commented he didn't like what Alexandra said. Well, I've had an opportunity of talking to her for 2 hours on two programs. I liked Alexandra. I thought that she was sincere. I think that we owe her a debt of gratitude for all the work she's done, but I do believe that probably they fed her some very bad information. But certainly she had an opportunity to talk to a woman who had gone into the tomb, that's what they call where the Skulls and Bones is, and this woman had been brought in to repair some of the pictures that were there, some of the oil paintings that had been badly damaged. And, of course, then she gave some insight into what was in there, a tremendous amount of German and Nazi paraphernalia that was there. And, of course, you know, the fact that they could steal the skull of Geronimo, the Indian chieftain, and nothing is ever done. These people are above the law. And as she pointed out, the police in the New Haven, Connecticut area are afraid of Skull and Bones because, of course, they wield tremendous power. How can a secret society wield power? Because its members control our country in large. And, of course, they're bound together by these strange secret oaths. But I thought that Alexandra's description of the Skull and Bones wedding was worth the entire cost of the book. Because here is a description of one of their services put forward by somebody who hasn't sworn the secret oaths. And I think when you've sworn those secret oaths, you're not going to tell the truth. And a woman, though, actually had an opportunity to witness this. And Alexandra tells about these men who represent the leadership of our country, there in a Skull and Bones wedding, wearing black robes and black hoods, and chanting in a strange language these pagan chants. And this woman who was watching this was shocked that this was a pagan ritual. And when she finally got up and shouted and identified that she was watching, they raced over to her, and one of them said in a menacing way, "You never tell anybody what you've seen." Why? Because they don't want the American people to realize that our leaders are involved in a pagan cult. What was your take on that story, Chris?
I thought it was one of the best parts of the book. And yes, I think that her book is a bit of a smokescreen, a whitewash, and a modified limited hangout. But you did a masterful job, Dr. Monteith, of interviewing her, and I strongly recommend that people listen to those interviews that you have up on your website, and you'll be congratulated. And she seems to say a bit more when she's talking rather than
like I say, her book, I mean, she deals with the Nazi thing with one sentence in there, and she dismisses a lot of, she calls them the legends of Skull and Bones, and she tries to dismiss them. One thing that I noticed that she talked about, it was that there was no underground, because, you know, and she starts off the book about she's talking to some New Haven policemen, and they're saying, she's telling them that she's waiting to see if George Bush is going to show up, and they tell her, well, George Bush can get there anywhere, because there's these tunnels, and she just says, well, no, there isn't any. She has a map of the inside, and she says there isn't any tunnels. Well, if you look at her layout of Skull and Bones, first off, she doesn't have the layout of the building correct, and second off, she only talks about two floors. And we know from a break in the 1870s that there's a basement. So, and she does show that there's some tunnels to Weir Hall, which is not a part of Skull and Bones. It is owned by Yale University. And then the other thing is about Yale is, and this is true actually of most universities in the United States, is that you have steam tunnels underneath the whole campus. Because these campuses were built in the 1800s. Well, excuse me, Yale was built in the 1700s.
1701, as a matter of fact.
Right, 1701. And they have a central power plant, and they deliver and they create steam there at the central power plant, and then they pipe this steam to all the other buildings. And since these pipes, you know, go bad at some times, they have tunnels that go along with them. I mean, one of the, you can get in trouble at Yale. They hand you out a little thing when you're a freshman, and one of the things that they say that you can get in trouble with is if you go down into those steam tunnels without permission. And so, what you have to, there is tunnels underneath Yale, and I strongly suspect that a person could get to Skull and Bones. I mean, it was interesting that the police were telling her that this was true, and she was saying, oh, no, that's not true, and just completely dismisses it. Another thing that I just recently discovered, I went to Yale to look at. I mean, if a person's ever been to Yale, Yale's an amazing place. It's this big Gothic buildings. And then along with that, you have seven basic secret societies, senior secret societies here at Yale. And you have these buildings which are big and no windows, or just very small slits on some of them. And they're built under, a lot of them were about the size of a lot of Masonic halls. But the Skull and Bones tomb is built on High Street, which... New Haven was settled by these people who were going to build a New Jerusalem here, and they came over here because they thought that God was going to punish England, and so they came over here with their saints to for the apocalypse, to save these saints and they would be the saved people here, and they built New Haven on nine squares. And on one of the alleys now is High Street of these original nine squares. And the tomb is on that. And to get to the tomb, you have to go underneath this tunnel between the two art buildings. And then at the very other end of High Street, there is Grove Street Cemetery. And Grove Street is one of the original nine squares. So this is the boundary of the original nine squares. And then there is it's either 16 or 18 acres of bones. And this was started as the Garden of the Dead, and it's one of, they say there was the first place in the world where they had a cemetery where you had family plots, and you could buy these things, and you have people still being buried there today. And at the corner of Grove and High Street, you have Book and Snake. The Book and Snake tomb is three stories of white marble, no windows at all, four big columns on the front and a big black door, completely surrounded by a fence that its posts are caduceus, the intertwined serpents.
Right.
And producers.
This is, of course, this is one of the senior secret societies.
This is another senior secret society. You had Bob Wen, and the original picture, I have original picture of Book and Snake, founders, and they're sitting around a table similar like Skull and Bones with a Skull and Bones, around a Skull and Bones thing, too. So, I mean, they aren't just competing societies. There are relations between these societies.
Well, I think the important thing to understand is that when America was founded, the first colonies were here, in 1604, something like that, 1607, Jamestown, and then, of course, the Pilgrims were here in 1620. Harvard was built in about 1647, and it was built specifically to teach men, how to be ministers, because the whole purpose of America was to push the and advance the Christian faith. And, of course, there were many Protestant sects here, but they all agreed upon the divinity of Jesus Christ. But what people don't understand is the Rosicrucians were here, probably by 1640 anyway, and they were, of course, an occult organization sent over from England to gain control of America. Well, very soon they controlled Harvard, and by 1701, why, of course, Harvard had been completely taken over by evil. And the wicked people who were anti-Christian had taken over this once great institution, which was Harvard, built, of course, to train ministers. So then they built a Yale, and that was in 1701. So it's actually 300 years old. And it was built then to train the men to go into the ministry. And, of course, then by, 1832, when this man named Russell, and, of course, he was part of this family that had been involved in the opium trade, and he was a undergraduate at Yale. He went over to Germany and came in contact with a secret society there, and their symbol was a skull and bones. He came back then to Yale, and he formed the second chapter of this Germanic society, which may or may not have been affiliated with the Illuminati. Alexandra really couldn't say one way or the other, but it was formed there, and the first graduating class was in 1833. But here now, by this time, the wicked people have already taken over Yale, and that was why then they had to build Princeton so they have a place to train ministers. So each one of these universities was taken over by the dark side. And, of course, by 1833, Yale had already gone to the dark side. And then you have all these secret societies created among the Scroll and Keys and Book and Snake and all of these. Skull and Bones, I think, was the first and certainly is by far the most important of the Yale secret societies because, at least from what Alexandra says in her book, as far as the marriage ceremony, they have truly pagan ceremonies are complete with black robes and black hoods. But, of course, it's very difficult to let the American people know that because, after all, two of our presidents, George Herbert Walker Bush, controlled the presidency for 12 years, 8 years as the vice president of Ronald Reagan, and then 4 years under his own administration, and now his son is our president. And we're told he's a born-again Christian. But, of course, why doesn't he renounce this society which is dedicated to death? And, of course, to really a pagan belief, because there is nothing, as Alexandra said, and I like Alexandra. I think that she's a nice person. I think she tried to do a good job, but I don't think she understands the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged. I really don't. And, of course, George W. Bush, if he was a born-again Christian, would renounce this whole and all the secret oaths that he has signed, that he has been involved in, wouldn't you think?
Oh, he should. I mean, he's just a front, and he's lying so that he can get the support of the Christians, and then also he can use divisive measures to divide the people, and whatnot. But right there, also, like say at Grove Street, on the other side, there's Book and Snake. On the other side is the Sterling Law School, which looks like a big cathedral. And then right at the end of High Street, there is a huge Egyptian gate. It was built by it's the same sandstone as the tomb is built out of, done by the same architect. And, I mean, this is just a gigantic structure, an Egyptian gate. And on it has the Rosicrucian symbol, it goes back to Egypt. The circle with the wings and the snakes are on this gate with a big sign that says, "The dead shall be raised." And then you go into this 12 acres, or excuse me, 16 acres of cemetery, which is very valuable land, just jammed up against New Haven and Yale. Right in the very middle of this, you have a crypt, the Crypt of St. John, which is again built out of the same sandstone as Skull and Bones and this gate, and has this little compound around it, and it also has the circle with wings and the snakes, and it's the only structure inside the graveyard that has this. And one thing that I had done was I had studied magic and mysticism for about 5-6 years. And I'm really glad I did, because it helped me to understand a bit how these people operate. And one thing that I noticed that you and Alexandra talked a bit about was about the death motif and the death culture of Skull and Bones. I mean, you've got a society here that has as its symbol a death's head, something that, you know, was put on bottles of poison and whatnot. And when you look at these people in the text of magic and mysticism, really what you see is a multi-generational cult of sorcerers who believe in necromantic sorcery, that believe in the power of death. And they create death. That's why we, you know, I mean, what's a big thing that comes out of war is death. And once, you know, a lot of people say, well, there's no conspiracy, it's just the system. Well, if you look at the manipulations that this society, along with their DKE brothers and a few other people, did in the late 1800s, they helped set up a system. So that by the time 1913 came around, we had an income tax and a Federal Reserve that then helped capitalize and pay for World War I, and you know, and brought about all this death and destruction. And then we had World War II, where the Skull and Bones people were involved heavily with the atomic bomb, which brought a lot of death. Stimson takes credit in his biography for talking Harry Truman into dropping the atomic bomb on Japan. And my father, just by chance, after he was on MacArthur's staff, they sheep-dipped him into G2 from OSS and put him on MacArthur's staff because MacArthur didn't want anybody from OSS on his staff. And then after they took the Philippines, my dad was head of all of research and analysis for the invasion of Japan. And he told me several times that we did not have to drop the bomb. There was no military reason or, you know, real reason to do it other than to show the power, and it created a lot of death.
And I think your dad was a very, very smart man. And of course, as we pointed out many times, the Japanese were ready to surrender 6 months. They had actually asked 5 times to surrender, and we wouldn't accept their surrender. If you'd like that verified, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you a copy. It's not a very good copy, but it's legible, of the Chicago Tribune on the day that the treaty was signed on the battleship Missouri that ended the Second World War, pointing out that the Japanese had been trying for 6 months to surrender, and the invasions of Okinawa, Iwo Jima, and dropping the bomb were totally unnecessary, unless, of course, you wanted to kill as many people and create as much suffering as you possibly could. And then, of course, it really all makes sense. 1 million people died every month as we prolonged the war and prolonged the war and prolonged the war. And of course, you know, this whole thing about Skull and Bones, you were talking about Stimson. Stimson was Skull and Bones.
Oh, yes.
Like George Bundy, who was intimately involved in bringing us into Vietnam, Skull and Bones.
His brother, too.
Right.
His brother was Skull and Bones,
right.
Too.
Right. And of course, and Yale has a lot to do with that. Dean Acheson, who got us into the Korean War, was from another. I think he was Skrull and Kreese.
Yes, Skrull and Key.
All of these, in fact, Colonel Edward Mandel House, who, of course, was the really this Bengali figure behind Wilson. And although he didn't belong to the secret societies, of course, he had attended Yale as well. So much of what has gone wrong in America can be traced directly back to Yale. and to the secret societies there, and they're occult influence. And until we understand the occult influence, until we understand that if you go into the tomb of Skull and Bones, and Alexander describes his skulls, I mean, they got all sorts of skulls there. I mean, they got the skull of Geronimo. What are they doing with the skull of Geronimo, the great Indian chieftain? And she acknowledged that it probably is Geronimo's skull. What power did they get from that?
It's all about power.
Right?
Yes.
Well, of course, I mean, there's so much we can talk about, and I hope you'll come back with us again, Chris. And of course, you've been to New Haven, you've seen these things. It's an incredible experience to go to Yale, and I spent a lot of time in the Sterling Library. I didn't take the tour you did. Maybe one of these days you can tell us more about what's back there at Yale.
Right. Well, we're putting something up on our website. I've been working on it for a while, but the more I dig into it, the more I find correlations that show the mystical applications that these people use and the geomantic applications that these people use to continue on with their nefarious doings.
And I think that really is what's so important, to understand that behind everything from a political and ideological and theoretical point of view are the spiritual forces. That's basically what you're talking about, isn't it, Chris?
Yes. You get into a situation where these families have been involved with this for so long that it gets beyond an intellectual standpoint, and it gets to be Dad says, well, when I get to this point in the ritual, I do this and that, you know, because everybody that's involved with Skull and Bones, and it's not like Skull and Bones says do this, do that. If you read Tony's book, he talks about, when you have societies like this, you have an inner core, and you always have an outer core too, so to protect you, so that not everybody that's involved with it knows what's going on. But you definitely have some very strong mystical things, and you can trace Skull and Bones directly to the Illuminati. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You can read about it in Masonic literature and literature about Phi Beta Kappa that traces a secret society directly to the Illuminati. Illuminati was started in May 1st, 1776. Officially founded.
And of course, Phi Beta Kappa actually was a secret society, and of course, because of the fear of the Illuminati here in the United States, they of course wouldn't allow Phi Beta Kappa to continue as a secret society. We're out of time, Chris.
Okay.
God bless you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir. God bless you.
And we
Bye-bye.
Hope to get you on. I'll give you a call. We'll get you on again.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Sir. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and if anybody's interested in knowing more about the books that Chris carries, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for our leaders and our ministers. And please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And remember, of course, we're going to be putting on a meeting out at the Seascape Golf Course on the 23rd of November. We hope many of you want to be there. It's an all-day meeting. There'll be a luncheon. There'll be a syllabus. And, of course, we're going to cover everything that you need to know for the difficult times that lie ahead. Starting at 8 o'clock in the morning, going till 5 in the evening. Hope that you'll be there. Until then, well, till tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan. Remember our number if you want to call and make your reservation, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for the all-day seminar on the 23rd of November. Good night. May the Lord be with you.
Thank you so much. That was a fast 2 hours. night lady called, and you were getting Chris on the line.
Yeah.
And she just called and she said, that, you know, I just went to the Home Center program. And I said, thank you so much.
I'm glad you're here tonight.
I'm glad you got that one.
Okay, get formally
signed. What's that?